In the words of that great poet, Matthew McConaughey. All right, all right, all right. It's time for episode 70 of The Far Middle. This is your host, Nick DeOlias, and we've got a lot to talk about this week. So let's jump right into the dedication for episode 70. We're going with a pair of greats from the NFL. Both of them played in the same era. They both donned number 70, and both have what I'd call emotional ties to me for regional reasons that I'll explain when I walk through each. Now, the first is the great defensive lineman, Ernie Stotner. Until the early sort of 70s, when the Steelers really entered their heyday, Stotner was without a doubt the greatest Steeler ever. He shined bright for 14 years on teams that, well, to be blunt, teams that were bad. He never got a chance to play in a playoff game, but he was the best defensive lineman of his era. He played from 1950 to 1963, and during that time, he just completely battled game in and game out in the trenches. Over those 14 years, he missed a grand total of 6 games, despite playing through injuries that include broken bones. I think that's the definition of toughness. Now, Andy Russell, he was a very good linebacker for the Steelers. He played in the 60s and through sort of the mid-70s. So he sort of bridged. He was one of those players that bridged from when the Steelers were bad to when they became great. And he was a rookie in the 60s when Stotner was by then sort of a grizzled veteran toward the end of his career. Andy Russell tells a story of how one game, the play was over, and they're heading back to the huddle, the defense was, and he looks over at Stotner, and he sees Stotner holding his hand with his other hand, and Russell sees why. Stotner's thumb suffered a compound fracture, and there was some bone sticking out from where his thumb should be. And all Stotner's asking in the huddle is, what's the next play? What's the next play? So he finishes the series. He goes to the sideline, and he basically has his hand wrapped up where his thumb was wrapped, and his hand was wrapped basically into a giant tape club, and he goes and plays the rest of the game. Again, that's what you call tough. I would have been done for the season at that point and basically done for my entire career right on the spot. So Stotner becomes a longtime coach in the NFL after his playing days, and he was an instrumental contributor to the famed Doomsday defense in Dallas, where he served as defensive coordinator for a couple of years. And by the way, the Doomsday defense was one of my top 10 greatest NFL defenses of all time. Read that essay on nickdeolias.com when you get a chance. See where the Dallas Doomsday defense landed in the top 10. Tell me what you agree with and what you disagree with. I'll be getting plenty of feedback on that list. And most important, you know, Stotner, he was a true gentleman, always cordial, always nice to everybody he met, a great ambassador to the game. I got a signed picture from Stotner when I met him in the early 1990s. He signed it to me, but he also wrote on it that Pittsburgh was a great town. One of my favorite items in my collection for obvious reasons. Now, the other side of the duo dedication for 70 goes to another defensive standout and another NFL Hall of Famer who played in basically the same era as Stotner. This time, the position was middle linebacker, and that goes to the legendary middle linebacker Sam Huff. He played from 1956 to 1967, basically for the Giants and in Washington. And there are a couple of cool factoids about Huff that I wanted to share with you constant listeners. First, he hailed from nearby northern West Virginia in Farmington, to be exact. That was a company coal town, and his family worked in the mines as a predecessor for a predecessor company for the one that I work for now. At the time, during Huff's family, it was Consolidation Coal Company that was operating those mines around the town of Farmington. So his family lineage ties to my professional lineage with sharing the same company legacy, which is sort of cool. And as an aside, and as a serious note, there was a terrible mine disaster at Farmington, I want to say in the late 1960s, that people talk about to this day. Many fatalities, the event led to a lot of new safety standards in the Mine Health and Safety Act, and ultimately it could trace itself to the creation of MSHA, the federal agency. Now, another interesting factoid about Sam Huff, he played and was a star at WVU, West Virginia, and then he got drafted by the Giants. And he struggled as a rookie and in a camp when training camp ensued. He was on his way to hitch a ride out of town and just basically quit the Giants, potentially quit football. But there was an assistant coach on the Giants staff at the time that ran him down at the airport, convinced Sam Huff to stay. And Huff, of course, became a Hall of Famer and one of the best middle linebackers ever. Now, who was that assistant coach who went the extra step and stopped Sam Huff from quitting? His name was Vince Lombardi. I think he ended up in Green Bay at some point after that. and I think he enjoyed some moderate level of success. And the last interesting fact about Huff, first football player ever to be on the cover of Time magazine. This is the type of stuff you learn on the far middle, constant listeners. So joint dedication time for episode 70 to the defensive side of the football team, Ernie Stotner and Sam Huff. Let's start connecting dots. Stotner, he played in Pittsburgh, which is in Pennsylvania, of course. Huff was from West Virginia, played college at WVU, less than an hour's drive from where I'm sitting. Both Pennsylvania and West Virginia, they're smack in the middle of the Marcellus and Utica natural gas shale plays, which together constitute the most prolific natural gas basin on the planet. Huff, as I said, he was on the cover of Time magazine. That's a major periodical in the mainstream media. All of this brings us to the topic of how academia and the media, they often cut corners, they compromise standards, and they collaborate to present very misleading impressions of disfavored entities or industries or things like the domestic natural gas industry. And what I want to walk you through is a perfect example of what I'm talking about, and it deals with vilifying a noble industry like domestic natural gas in Appalachia by making the most serious and the most offensive of accusations. And I've got to thank at the start the great work done by the Marcellus Shale Coalition, the MSC, for much of what I'm about to tell you. Check out the details on their website if you want to learn more, or if you just want to access a great resource when it comes to a key industry that powers literally everything in our nation and world. So the web address for the Marcellus Shale Coalition is marcelluscoalition.org. Give that a look if you get a chance. This maddening story, it starts with unbased, ungrounded, made-up accusations by radical environmental groups that shale development in Appalachia was causing childhood cancers. And the basis for the accusations were a joke, and you'd laugh at it if it wasn't made on such a serious issue. But the environmentalists, they throw out that there's these issues and these things are occurring, and not only are there no consequences to saying this on a baseless manner, but on top of it, it gets broadcasted and picked up by their cohorts. So the media, which these days have dropped all objectivity and credibility, they trumpet it. Politicians from the left, they demand studies on it publicly. And academia, smelling money and research subsidy from government to go after an industry on top of it that academia doesn't like, they start clamoring to do, and I'm going to use air quotes, research, at least in this context, to figure out what's going on. Now, venerable Yale, they're in the middle of this feeding frenzy. And now Yale University and their researchers, they're in a bit of a conundrum. In August, researchers at this school, they published a study, an epidemiological study. And I know that sounds really technical, but what it means is that it's a statistical model and not, I repeat, not actual measurements and analysis of environmental data and exposure. And the statistical model run by the experts in academia created a paper that sort of summarized what the model was predicting, claiming that water was an exposure pathway for leukemia. Yet the same researchers at Yale, the very same ones, mind you, have previously published numerous exposure studies of areas with high shale development activity, and they concluded that chemical detections were rare, that's their term, or not attributable to unconventional oil and gas, again their term, and that, quote, no study to date has found widespread contamination attributable to unconventional oil and gas activity, end quote. So you've got a blatant contradiction from the same researchers. On the one hand, Yale researchers are saying water is an important route of exposure, but on the other hand, the same researchers conclude, quote, in the most comprehensive, end quote, water sampling studies that under unconventional oil and natural gas development, water contamination occurs rarely. Now, our friends at the Marcellus Shale Coalition, they did a great job calling out this contradiction. So which is it? In each exposure-based study, Yale and their researchers that they've done, they've come to the same conclusion. Unconventional oil and gas development does not impact groundwater or drinking water resources. An actual measurement of exposure trumps statistical models. One goes and sees or measures the reality while the other predicts the abstract. Now we have the media side of this mess that enters the fray. And guess what? For each of these exposure studies finding no impact, Yale didn't bother to publish a press release. But I think you know what's coming if you're a constant listener. Yale did go through the bother to issue a press release with this statistical model study claiming a possible link to childhood disease. In the media, which were not equally spoon-fed the previous studies, they simply regurgitated through clickbait headlines rather than asking any questions what the Yale press release was saying. So the media once again played along and refused to do its job. Now, a lot of people are outraged, and they see this as a dereliction of journalism to not ask simple, straightforward questions. Now, what type of questions should they ask? Hey, I'm no journalist, but I don't know, maybe something like, why does this statistical study assume water is a pathway when your previous studies that take actual water samples indicate no impacts from oil and natural gas or fracking activity? Now, unfolding here is the clear difference between what happens in reality versus these hypothetical abstract statistical models. We discuss this problem with the proven to be inaccurate climate models used to set energy policies and allocate trillions of dollars. We're seeing it yet again. In the reality, the body of academic studies and government reports based on actual exposure data, it continues to confirm that natural gas is developed safely, responsibly, and in a manner that protects public health and our environment. In Pennsylvania, the Department of Environmental Protection, the DEP, it's documented zero situations, zero, where chemicals associated with hydraulic fracturing have migrated into groundwater or surface water. It comes as no surprise as credible academic research confirms what DEP had found. And the specifics backing this up, you know, they're everywhere. On water, a 2020 study concluded waterways have been unaffected by development after reviewing data from streams and state forest lands where 500 unconventional natural gas shale wells have been drilled. In 2018, a Penn State study found that fracking had no major threats to groundwater, and in fact also identified an overall improving water quality trend in Bradford County, one of the most heavily drilled. And there's the Susquehanna River Basin Commission in Pennsylvania, which has been continuously monitoring water quality and quantity since shale development began in the state. Years of 24/7 data collection, it continues to confirm that natural gas development has had no discernible impact on water quality in the Susquehanna River Basin. That's using their words. So similar conclusions are found in air quality studies as well, with continuous air monitoring studies finding volatile organic compounds, using their terminology, well below health protective levels. But science, it's been assassinated at major universities these days. We've spoken about that on many prior episodes of The Far Middle. It's now all about the ideology and the political science. And unfortunately, studies that lack the necessary rigor to advance a scientific understanding, they are increasingly the favored approach, given the ability to generate alarming headlines and research dollars to feed that bureaucracy, to feed academia. It must be an Ivy League thing because Yale's not alone. In February, researchers with Harvard, they took a similar approach using flawed data, no actual measurements, to advance claims relating to senior citizen mortality. So this is an ongoing theme and a trend. And as these so-called studies are published, we have to see them, you know, for what they so often are, efforts to advance an anti-natural gas or domestic energy agenda to drive more dollars to already well-funded activist organizations, and of course, to serve as internet clickbait. I wrote a book on it, Precipice, that I encourage you to order on Barnes & Noble or Amazon and give it a read. And now the Marcellus Shale Coalition has called out a very troubling and disturbing example of this in the natural gas industry. As a Pennsylvanian, as part of the domestic energy industry, as an engineer, and as a citizen, I'm outraged, and I hope you are as well. Now, this dereliction of duty with the media and the bias that you see there, it throws us into the next topic in connection to discuss. And there is sort of a flip side to this issue. So while the media drops its standards and trumpets constructed black box statistical models that fly in the face of the actual observed and measured results, the same profession of journalism throws itself into backing up stories it likes without doing background or fact-checking that would have exposed something very different. So let's talk about one example of this failure that occurred about a decade ago, but that everyone is talking about today. So many people and constant listeners have asked me if I watched the Netflix documentary about Manti Te'o. And I think the title of it is Untold, The Girlfriend Who Didn't Exist, something very similar to that, if that's not it exactly. So Manti, he was the Notre Dame phenom linebacker who was the runner-up in the Heisman Trophy voting his senior year. He played and lost in a national championship game his senior year, and then he played a stint in the NFL, I think with the Chargers. But what everyone, sports fans or people who never watch sports, ties him to was an unfortunate event in 2013 when it came out that he was catfished by another person who pretended online to be his girlfriend, who then pretended to die. Tao dedicated his season to the deceased girlfriend, and it didn't exist, of course, the person didn't exist, and he never met the alleged girlfriend in person, and then it came out that, you know, this was all a hoax. So I think you all remember that story, right? It was everywhere that year. I mean, it was probably the biggest sports story of the year in 2013. Well, I did have a chance finally to watch the documentary on Netflix, and it was well done. I've got three observations after viewing it that I wanted to share with you. So first observation, most people in the media who talked about the documentary, they concluded that Manti Te'o came across as looking basically really bad. I didn't sense that. I saw mostly a victim, a naive person at the time, a kid at the time. So I saw mostly a victim there. Yes, you know, when he found out this person didn't exist and that it was a hoax, which he found out, I think, just before the national championship game and just before the combine for the draft, yes, he should have said something. So he has some fault. But overall, I thought the guy was likable and I feel was largely a victim. So I disagree with the sports media consensus on that point. Second sort of observation, the person who created and ran the hoax for years, to me, came across as a very dislikable individual, a perpetrator, frankly. And I kept asking myself as I'm watching this thing, was this a crime? Because it feels like there's a crime there. And in this documentary, the perpetrator sort of displays minimal remorse to the point where it's almost shocking to me when I was watching it. I mean, this person lied, misled, betrayed, and did so in a way where it became national news and ended up costing Manti Te'o in reputation and millions of dollars in contract money when he slipped in the draft due to all the drama. And the person who came up with all this offers an apology at points in the documentary, but it doesn't feel genuine. And instead, I almost sense like a giddiness to the day from the person over what they did. So like to this day, you can almost... I sensed that this individual was almost giddy about what had happened and what occurred. I find it sad and bothersome at the same time to see, frankly. So that was my second observation. My third observation connects back to the subject of media, because the biggest takeaway for me in this whole documentary and that mess was how the mainstream sports media was completely duped by the story, and they never found the wherewithal to perform really the simplest of diligence or background investigation on the story's obvious issues. So they bit off and they fell in love with the story, hook, line, and sinker. It was only until Deadspin, which at the time was a couple of guys working on computers in their apartments and in their parents' basements, they got an anonymous tip and did sort of the internet legwork to figure out the entire story was a bunch of BS. And if the mainstream media would have applied the most basic of journalistic standards, the story would have broken months or years prior to when it did. Now, did the mainstream media reform or self-assess because of all this once the real story broke from Deadspin? Heck no, right? Instead, you know, they piled onto the story of the fraud and they beat it to death, acting like the lemmings that the media has largely become. Yeah, I'd give it a recommendation to watch that documentary on Manti Te'o if you can. Most people see it as a cultural or a sports or sort of a reality TV topic. To me, it was something different. It was another alarming example of how what used to be what Thomas Jefferson viewed as the critical piece of self-government is now turned into an echo chamber that cheers for its favored subjects and basically boos its disfavored ones. All right, jump to the next dot. We're talking about data and how sometimes it's ignored by those in professions who should be following it instead. One of the topics I've discussed in the past and wrote about in Precipice is how income spreads look across the different quintiles of earned income in the United States. We hear often about income inequality and so on, and we talked about the historically low and alarming workforce participation rate, which is hovering in the low 60s in terms of participation. We've talked about it before on the far middle. Well, let's combine these issues to talk about something surprising and concerning at the same time. Our Census Bureau down in D.C. reports household income across five demographic levels, or quintiles, the bottom quintile being the lowest 20% of income, and the top quintile being the highest. Now, the conventional wisdom is that income inequality has never been wider. Well, not exactly, for a couple reasons that tie to the theme of this episode 70. First, the Census Bureau makes a few key assumptions that matter greatly when reporting income. For one, they don't count government aid or transfer payments to those receiving it, which are typically those in the lower quintiles. For another, the Census Bureau does not deduct taxes paid from income. So those are two hugely important and outsized assumptions when calculating income that don't get any mention or attention, it seems, these days when they should. So what if you normalize the data where you deduct taxes paid and you add transfer payments received to the income numbers for each quintile? Well, it might shock you. On a per capita basis, the bottom quintile household received 14% more income than the average second quintile household and 3.3% more income than the average middle income quintile. In other words, there is income equality, not inequality, across 60% of the U.S. population, from the poorest up through to the middle class. And it's largely because of government transfer payments to the bottom quintile and taxes paid by the middle quintile. And I think that creates, or maybe exposes is a better word, because I'm not sure which is the result and which is the cause, some problems. Problems we've been discussing in prior episodes of The Far Middle. We talked about that paltry workforce labor participation rate in the low 60s. Consider that in 1967, 68% of working age people in the bottom quintile of earned income, they actually worked. In 2017, that dropped to 36%. So we went from 68% in that bottom quintile working to 36%. So how many future doers and achievers and innovators are idly sitting at home day after day because government policies are incentivizing individuals to not realize their potential? That's beyond a shame. And why do we keep penalizing the middle class, the backbone of this nation, every chance government gets to do so? That thought offers up a quick hit on another connection. Student debt forgiveness is another example of that ill dynamic at play. People working and making less than college grads who pay for wiping clean the higher earning college grads' loans. That makes no sense, unless you're a politician wanting to be Santa Claus handing out taxpayers' money to collect votes in the short term, or you're a college looking for even more subsidy via regressive taxation like this kind so you can keep growing and consuming the value of others. We may need to dive deeper on that one on a future episode. Well, it is time to close down episode 70. Let me end with a question for you. Would Harrison Ford, Steven Spielberg, Leonardo DiCaprio, Prince Harry, and our climate czar John Kerry, what do they all have in common? Well, they're all labeled as eco-warriors, and they give speeches on climate change, and they make a part of their work, at least for those of them that work. So I came across a speech recently that was really entertaining that I wanted to share with you. It was from Harrison Ford. He was talking about climate change. So here's what Harrison Ford said. It's hard to devote yourself to a cause that is so urgent and not be able to get the traction needed to make the change that is absolutely necessary. It's hard to read the headlines, floods, fires, famines, plagues, and tell your children that everything is all right. It's not all right. Damn it, it's not all right. He almost sounded like Han Solo when he was given that speech. Well, Harrison Ford, that's what he said. Now, what did he do? What were his actions? 8 trips in private jets, over 5,000 miles in less than 2 months, according to Celebrity Jets data for Harrison Ford. Steven Spielberg, he was worse. 16 trips, 17,000 miles since mid-June. He's gone on record voicing concerns and being terrified of climate change. Another one of these celebrities drives electric vehicles to their private jets on the way to their private jet flights. That's a ridiculous optic. And some of these other celebrities that I mentioned, they've got super yachts that I'm assuming guzzle vast amounts of carbon to power them. Now, all these celebrities, you know, they use private jets. That creates outsized carbon emissions and footprints on a per capita basis. It's a level of hypocrisy to where the individual must be suffering a complete lack of self-awareness. Can someone over the next week send these individuals a note to tell them how the optics look ridiculous and save them from further embarrassment? While you're busy with that, We will talk again in a week. Bye for now.